Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
A new look at Finland's most famous musician. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer, and today you'll find why composer Jan Sibelius, well, you'll find him on Finland's money and postage stamps, but we'll also find out why he's important to American listeners, too. Then, forget about spelling bees. In the Islamic world, kids compete to chant the Quran, the whole Quran, from memory. And a new opera based on a Björk character from a Lars von Trier movie. First, though, a survey of American listeners in the 1930s asked who their favorite composer was. The answer was not Beethoven, wasn't even Copland or Gershwin. It was the Finnish composer Jan Sibelius. But by the time Sibelius died in 1957, his music had fallen out of favor. It was considered hopelessly old-fashioned. It came roaring back in the 80s and 90s, and Sibelius's music is now the topic of this year's annual Bard Music Festival. Conductor and festival co-director Leon Botstein joins us to tell us why. Leon, welcome back.
Well, thank you for having me, John.
Now, you are known for shining a light on the undiscovered or the forgotten, neglected corners of the music world. Sibelius, pretty big figure. Why center this festival on him?
The Bard Music Festival has always chosen composers that are well-known but tries to look at them in a different way. So we did Haydn and Beethoven and Tchaikovsky. So Sibelius fits into that category. Actually, in the Bard Music Festival, we rarely go to really unknown people because nobody will come. So you want to actually have a figure whom people are really curious about. And Sibelius is as complicated and as curious a case as you can come up with. And you put it very well. I mean, he's the icon of Finland. There's no composer in any nation that has come to represent a national sensibility as much as Sibelius has Finland. So he's interchangeable. And even shaved his head and began to look very granite, sort of austerely Finnish. And so it's probably oppressive for a Finnish musician. The shadow is far larger than even Bartok in Hungary. So, and you're absolutely right. Olin Downs was the critic in the New York Times, is a great case of somebody who has hammered use the bully pulpit. And he wanted to make Sibelius the modern Beethoven. And he succeeded, but it was also because the music was so immediately accessible. Mm-hmm. So accessible that the British, where there was a huge following for Sibelius, there was also an elite crowd that thought, this is trash. And a really Philistine person, a person whom you would sort of sneer at in if you were sort of a snob by training, would love Finlandia or, I don't know, the Fifth Symphony or something like this. And because these people really didn't understand Beethoven and Mozart. And, of course, Copland, who was enraged by his popularity. I think Adorno is reputed, not really.
Copland was enraged?
Well, yes, Copland was enraged by his popularity.
A little bit of jealousy there?
Terrible composer. And then, of course, Adorno is reputed to have said that he was the worst composer in history. So, you know, so this, then what happens is, as you say, then suddenly when we were all growing up, it was déclassé. It was slumming. You know, you did it in the dark. You know, Sibelius wasn't, you know, acceptable subject of conversation, except for the violin concerto. There, everybody deferred to Heifetz. You know, Heifetz mm-hmm. picked it up. And he ran with it, and he put it into the repertory. It's probably the most played violin concerto in the business, the second version, the one that Richard Strauss premiered, actually, in Berlin. And then what happens is that, as you say, in the period when, you know, modernism takes a hit, and Rockberg and Del Tredici and that whole generation comes up, and then comes Philip Glass and John Adams, really, ironically, the real connection between Sibelius is with Morton Feldman. With a certain kind of static.
Very abstract.
Totally, totally. Yeah. You look at Tapiola, the last really symphonic work of Sibelius, and you see shades of a kind of static sonority, a kind of very strangely abstract sound. But Sibelius starts to come back. Previn is very crucial. The English, though, have always been pro-Sibelius. And
to this day, Sir Colin Davis, the English conductor, remains a major proponent
of
Sibelius.
It's a huge British Sibelius tradition, yeah.
But he is the ultimate, as you say, he is the ultimate Finnish composer. his music, especially Finlandia, the work we opened the show with right. today, kind of associated with the modern nation state of Finland.
Yes, and I mean, he sided with the whites in the Civil War and after Finnish independence. But the truth is, he wasn't really, he was an aristocratic man. He wasn't really comfortable with populism.
Wasn't comfortable with Finnish either.
No,
was
he was Swedish speaking, and he only actually learned Finnish because I think his father-in-law insisted in order to marry Aino, he had to be really fluent in Finnish, which he never totally achieved. And he was in that generation that fell in love with this sort of construct of Finland through the Kalevala,
which is the ancient epic poem.
Yes, yes, which Lunotar is from. And he was in this young Finn movement in a way, but the truth is that what's interesting about Sibelius music has nothing to do with Finland, and it's interesting we think of it as Finnish only because we've learned to make
think
that
of
association.
Him. Yeah. Well, this piece you mentioned, Lunatar. This is one of his settings, one of many many settings of this epic Finnish folk poem, the Kalevala. A little bit of Sibelius's piece Lunatar, one of many settings of the ancient Finnish epic poem, the Kalevala, that occupied Sibelius throughout his career. Leon Botstein is celebrating Sibelius and His World. That is the name of this year's edition of the Bard Music Festival, August 12th through 14th and August 19th through 21st, so essentially two weekends in the middle of August at the Fisher Center at Bard College. And, Leon, as we've been talking about, you know, we identify Sibelius so closely with one tiny corner of the world, Finland. But you're calling this Sibelius and His World. How extensive was his life?
Well, hugely extensive. In this piece you just heard, you see what is important about Sibelius. Number one, it's a visual composer. It's not about language. It's not about developing themes. It's not about variation of themes. It's not about complex counterpoint. It's about sonority and time. And therefore, it's kind of a visual imagination. You can hear, you know, shades of Philip Glass, shades of minimalism. The sound is an element of composition. It is atmospheric and profoundly architectural. So you have a vision of sound. It's a mixture of sight and sound, a kind of synesthesia, if you will, of writing. And he breaks as a modernist, not as a conservative. He breaks from the analogy between language and music. And he's not interested in going back to tradition. There's something antique about some of the harmonic language, but really it is about what can't be expressed by language. So it's a kind of emotional, visual transformation of time, of your experience of time. So there's a lot of repetition, mm-hmm. a lot of static sound.
And that abstraction, that tendency towards abstraction that you mentioned before, very surprising to think of Sibelius as a modernist, but of course this is what you're known for, is giving us different perspectives on composers we think we know. We think we know Sibelius as this sort of marble-headed, you know, very cerebral guy. Did he sow his wild oats? I mean, was he...
He was a very complicated man. First of all, he was an alcoholic. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he fell silent in the last 30 years of his career. So the last piece, Tapiola, really major piece, is 25, and he revises constantly. He was very insecure. You know, he spent a year in Berlin. He spent a year in Vienna studying. He was very influenced by Bruckner, hearing Bruckner when he was in Vienna. He he spent time in Paris and also in Italy. He wasn't quite as isolated as some people think. He was very in touch with European trends.
Mm-hmm. Was he superstitious? And the reason I ask is, you mentioned Tapiola, his last piece. His last symphony was the Symphony No. 8. And during that 30-year fallow period during which he didn't compose, there were constant rumors of a ninth symphony, which is a big superstition among composers.
Well, it depends how you count. If you count, you're right. If you count Kullervo as one, then they're nine. There would have been a ninth.
But right,
if you
but
don't count Kullervo, it was eight. He didn't number Kullervo. So it's a little weird. He tries to avoid the issue, but he does destroy the last symphony from all we can gather, which he promised Koussevitzky and so on. He was not so much superstitious as I think he was a deeply hidden and very insecure. So these pieces, the Fifth Symphony, they all go through revision. You know, some composers don't revise. You know, they write and they go on to the next thing. He was a kind of composer agonized over Mahler, too, but very different from Gustav Mahler. You know, for him, he was not in the idea of music into very heavily into the notion of music as narrative. There are some narrative pieces, but he really thought music was somehow connected to nature. He had a very close friend, the architect Eliel Saarinen, who was the father of Eero Saarinen, and to my mind, Eliel Saarinen is a much greater architect, who did the Helsinki Railway Station and then also Kleinhans Hall in Buffalo. And these were a generation of people who thought that art had some kind of relationship to the natural, to the organic, which means they're circular forms. They're organic forms that turn on themselves. And there's a kind of, you know, meditative quality to the whole thing. And the same thing in the use of space. So he was insecure about his own compositional craft. Interestingly, the orchestra was his medium. I mean, there is a string quartet, wonderful string quartet. But in point of fact, in that parallel with Mahler, it's very interesting because he does use the Wagnerian instrumentarium, although he didn't like tubas. Apparently the tuba player in Helsinki was terrible. So most of the city have no tuba parts. Who knows why, but that's he didn't like.
Well, that's a pretty good guess.
So the fact is that the orchestral sonority is a building block of composition.
And the Symphony No. 5 underwent a wholesale revision. This is what the revised version of the second movement of that symphony sounds like, by Sibelius. Finnish composer Sibelius, his Symphony No. 5, the second movement. That is the version that we've come to know and love. Leon Botstein, the conductor and co-director of the Bard Music Festival, celebrating Sibelius and his world. Two weekends in August, the 12th through 14th and 19th through 21st at the Fisher Center at Bard College. And Leon, have you heard the original? It wouldn't surprise me to learn that you've conducted the original version of the Sibelius.
Never have. In fact, I've never looked at it. So I only know the one we do all the time. It's interesting that I've looked at the first version of the Violin Concerto, which I don't think is persuasive. I understand why he changed it. And I think accepted wisdom is most of the revisions are in the right direction. As composer of that generation, when they heard something, they revised it. And
somebody recently recorded the original version of the Sibelius
Fifth. Sure.
And man, his instincts to revise were spot on.
Absolutely. I think there's a fair amount. I always respect composers who don't want you to look you know, go in the waste paper basket.
Right.
But what's interesting is when you hear the Sibelius, you understand why it's so audience friendly. Mm-hmm. When compared to sort of Schoenberg Opus 31, you know, people are going to think, well, this is easy listening and got hammered for it. It's very simply constructed and so. But it is about a different sense of musical time. The end of the Fifth Symphony is one of the most bizarre. Mm-hmm.
Those oddly spaced silences.
And this change, slight change chords. It's a really an odd thing. And I think there is a real struggle in Sibelius of how do you communicate? You know, one of the things we think about the early 20th century is when people got exhausted, began to experiment because... You know, we think we communicate when we speak normally, but actually we don't really communicate, and language doesn't really quite do it, and the illusion of realism, a painting, a photograph, doesn't quite do it. So you search for a medium in which you can go deeper, and music seems to be such a medium. But how do you actually go about it without sort of invoking clichés? How do you become really original? Sibelius really found a way, which I think is very inspirational to young composers. And you try to think, you know, the struggle. He was not a quick study, so he was not a good instrumentalist. You know, he didn't win an audition to play in an orchestra. Mm-hmm. He didn't play the violin as well as Elgar did, even. And so he was not a whiz kid. He worked hard at what he did and struggled.
So what do you make of this kind of retirement, this 30-year period? During which, and after, I mean, that's it. It's the last 30 years of his life. There's no second act here. He is silent for 30 years, a man who works so hard to communicate.
I think there one explanation is that he composed himself out, that he somehow, after the Seventh Symphony and Tapiola, he sort of said what he wanted to say. The second explanation, he became the prisoner of his own success. Mm. In the post-war period, there was an uncomfortable moment during the Nazi era where he was the most often played non-German composer in the Third Reich, and he was the darling of conservatives, and he took awards from Germany. He was not a bad guy, but he was no particular hero on this front. And then after the war, you know, he became emblematic of Finland in the sort of Cold War period where Russia was a real danger. And I think he just became an icon. You know, he was a postage stamp. So he lived the life of a postage stamp. He was a public figure. Mm-hmm. I think his funeral was the largest public event in Finnish history. You know, and when you become larger than life, how do you say something? You know, everybody's waiting for the next thing, and you can never measure up. So he just fell silent. And then he was an addict. He was obviously a person who suffered enormously from depression and huge mood swings, not to psychologize. But as a young man, he was, you know, had bouts, huge bouts of rakiness, you know, and
a later bout of throat cancer with particularly brutal kind of
treatment.
Almost medieval treatment.
But he survived, smoked cigars mm-hmm. to the very end. The thing he loved most after music was cigars.
Sibelius and His World is the name of the Bard Music Festival taking place at Bard College's Fisher Center August 12th through 14th and 19th through 21st. Leon Botstein's been with me, the conductor and festival co-director. You mentioned the string quartet. We'll end with a little bit of Intimate Voices. This is the more personal side.
Most personal. And you see the both French and Russian influence, too, that you also can hear in Finlandia.
Leon, thank you so much for joining us. Always a pleasure.
My pleasure.
Up next, a new documentary looks into the world's oldest Quran reciting contest. We'll talk with the director. And later, a sneak preview of Danish composer Poul Ruders' new opera called Selma Yezkova. This is Soundcheck.